broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Welcome, everyone, to the Refresh Your Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen. We are excited to be with you today. It's going to be an amazing hour, tax and legal strategies, talking about building wealth. And today is open forum. It's the time when you get to send in your questions, and we give you free advice. I mean, it's really a great deal for you guys, and it's actually fun for Mark and I to come on together and give some advice, some planning, and interact with you guys. Of course, you know, if you're following the show, you can always email us questions in advance of the open forum show. We give announcements on that on our newsletter, and you can be putting them up on social media as well. But you got to do it before the show.
Yeah, and this is an exciting show every month. And we want to thank all of you that are regular listeners and those that have, maybe this is your first time listening to Refresh Your Wealth. We're both attorneys. I'm also got a little tax hat I wear called CPA once in a while. And we're just helping our clients around the country with small business issues, building wealth. And so I think today we got a good range of questions. And I'll give this, again, a little tip out right from the start is, again, we do this, we're trying to do the open forum show the last Wednesday of every month. So save up some of those good general tax and legal questions and send us an email to mark@kkoslawyers.com or Matt, Matt@kkoslawyers.com. And we'd love to hit them on the open forum show.
Yeah. And, you know, I got so many questions. I got a range of questions from legal uses of marijuana to Roth IRA conversions. So, I mean, we're going to hit from top to bottom there. Some highs and lows.
Yeah. And we got, I think our question of the week to hit first. Now, for those that are not regular listeners, we pose a question that the listener gets to answer, and the first one to respond can win a copy. Will win the first one to respond. Will win. This isn't a chance to win. You will win. So if you respond with the proper answer, you can receive a wonderful gift. So Matt, why don't you remind us last week's question? I think it was yours that you'd posed.
Yeah, last week's question was about what type of deed. A deed transfer for a property, would you want to use when transferring title from your personal name to your LLC, for example, for a rental you may own, or this could be a deed from your personal name to your trust, like for your residence, as an example. Now, the correct answer, this was by Trent, who wrote in from Kaysville, Utah, and Trent wrote in with the answer saying you would want to use a warranty deed, and a warranty deed is the correct answer. There's a couple reasons you want to do that. Generally, the warranty deed is going to transfer title insurance. And so if you bought the property in your personal name and you got a title insurance policy that says, you know, there was no liens or any defects in title, when you transfer by warranty deed to your own LLC or to your trust, that title policy and that protection covers the LLC or the trust as well. So you get the benefit of that coverage. That's the typical reason we'll try and use a warranty deed. In California, the operative word would be a grant deed. Of course, they always got to do something a little different there. But that's the answer to the question Trent wrote in. Trent, you let us know. I'll reply back to you to see what book you want, a copy of mine or Mark's. And, of course, now this week we're not giving a new question out. Following next catch up on the show next week, we'll be giving a new question of the week out. But we're going to be answering, of course, all of your open forum questions today.
Yeah, love it. Great question you posed, Matt. I'll be putting on my thinking cap this week, come up with a hard question for next week, and it'll be good. All right. Well, okay, so with open forum, We got a lot of questions. We want to jump right into it. This show is about you, the listener. And I know how hard it can be to get a quick answer from an attorney or CPA. Sometimes I need a quick answer from a lawyer that specializes in a different area of the law than me. And it can be a challenge. So we're going to jump right into it. We're going to hit the open forum and go for it. Now, Matt, may I? I've got one here. Can I throw it out there?
Yeah, let's just start hammering away at this.
All right. Well, this is from Elaine at Consult by Design, and she asks a very common question that we get at our firm. If I don't talk about this almost daily in some consultation in some form or another, it's been a weird day. So this is a really good question Elaine poses. She says, how do I use a combination of an LLC and an S-Corp in my real estate dealings? Holding real estate for long term, having a couple of employees. Why these formats? Question mark. Well, I'll give you my take on this. I'm sure Matt will add to this as well. Is that we have been a firm believer over the last 15 years of working with our clients that we want to have a dividing line. Think of it down the whiteboard or on a piece of paper between your operations and your holdings. Now, anybody that's been to a workshop of ours or read our books, you know where I'm going with this. It's good review for you. But for any of our new listeners, this sometimes sounds revolutionary. And that is, you're going to use an S corporation on the left side of the equation for your operations, fix and flips, management of real estate, property manager, a broker, a real estate agent, inspections, appraisals, anything to do with real estate that is providing a service or getting a commission or flipping a property that you hold less than 12 months. That's going to be in your S corp on the left. Now, you might start out with an LLC that converts to an S or even a sole proprietorship that converts to an S. I just had a client this morning that that's been a sole proprietorship for years and just getting killed on taxes. We're going to an S corp. But on the right side of the equation is where the holdings are. And that's where you're going to use your LLC and then a combination of LLCs. We might use series LLCs, a parent LLC and babies. Who knows? We're going to build this structure to hold your rentals on the right side. So Elaine, that is the general format. Employees are going to usually be on your S corp side because you're going to be providing some sort of unique service, I'm sure, if there's employees. So anyway, there you go. That's the basic format. Matt, anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, and we like to separate those and keep them left side, right side, because we want your operations, where you may have liability, to have its own entity, the S corporation, that's separate from the entity you use to hold assets, like the rentals or any other assets or investments you may have. And that keeps them separate for liability purposes so that all your assets don't get tied up in some operational issue you have in your operational business. So there's tax reasons, for it, and asset protection reasons. And I agree, Mark, that was revolutionary. When you did the left side, right side, put it on a whiteboard, it was like, why doesn't everybody explain it like that? Why didn't I learn it in law school like that?
Yeah. It is weird, and Matt, maybe we take it for granted because it's become very intuitive to us. Mm-hmm. And but as we do workshops around the country and talk to people, they're always like, oh my gosh, that makes sense. And you're right. Even other lawyers and CPAs that we teach this to just feel it's a voice of clarity. So, and then you build upon it. It's the foundation. So great question, Elaine. Thanks for giving us a little softball here right out of the gate. This is good. This is good.
All right. Well, I've got a question here from Sanan. This is a Roth IRA contribution question. And the question is there a maximum age limit for one to contribute money into a Roth IRA?
Ooh, good one.
As long as one has earned income. Now, and he also says, so glad you guys brought back the open form show. That's true. We didn't have a hiatus for a little while on the open form show, but we're certainly going to have this every month. So now I'll jump in on this, Mark, and you chime in.
Oh, this is your area, baby. This, yeah. You talk about this in your sleep. Your wife's told me. during the day when I saw her. Yeah,
that's right. I don't want to make this weird. So Roth IRAs, I do dream about them. Now this is what's cool about a Roth IRA. There is no maximum age limit. Now for a traditional IRA, you're not going to be able to contribute after 70 and a half, because on a traditional IRA, the IRS is saying, no, you got to start taking money out of this account because we need to start taxing that. and we don't want to give you any more deductions to put money in. But in a Roth, there's no age restriction in terms of contributions. There's also no required minimum distributions. You don't have to start pulling it out. So that is a difference on the Roth. So Sinan, you could contribute. I don't, you know, you may be at that age limit, but at 70 and a half, you're not capped out. As long as you do have earned income, you could still be contributing. And that's earned income, the second part of your question, that could be on a W-2 or a 1099 type income that flows through in a self-employment income to you. So either one of those would work to be earned income to make the contribution. Now, here's a little tip, and this is something to look forward to because there is a new bill on IRAs that I have been reading. It's 60 pages of freaking code changes to the tax code that has to do with IRAs. And one of the things they actually may be changing, if you're still working, you may be able to actually contribute to a traditional IRA after 70 and a half. That is one of the proposals. So I'll be doing a summary on this. There's actually some proposals on self-directed IRAs. So be looking out for my website. I'm going to be putting a summary up and a blog article on it that'll be pretty extensive on those changes. So just some breaking news for you.
Yeah, and I want to throw this out too, give my partner a little love here, is that yesterday I was on a call with a client that was doing an IRA, LLC, and self-directing. And I said, well, have you read Matt's book yet?
It literally is the nationwide best-selling book on self-directing. It's everywhere. So please just get the book, and you can go to sdirahandbook.com. That's SD, as in self-directed, SDIRAhandbook.com. Just get over there, get the book, and it'll answer so many of these questions. I know, Matt, you're coming out a second edition here someday. I guess we don't know when, so people get the handbook, but when it comes out, I'm sure you'll be getting. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, thanks for that endorsement. Mark J. Kohler approved book, everybody. You heard it here.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Okay, well, let's jump over to another question. Now, Matt, I'm going to add one thing. Folks, an inherited IRA is amazing because your family can continue to use that IRA for many years. So if you're over 70 and a half and you want to leave some sort of unique benefit to a family member, opening up a Roth IRA and making that grandchild or child the beneficiary can be an amazing benefit that you leave for them. Even if it's a few thousand dollars, it's something that they can build upon later. So It's really exciting. So we have many people over 70 and a half still using the Roth IRA and starting them up.
Okay, Matt. Well, I've got another question for you. And this is a hard one for me because this is all about court. And I usually just watch Law and Order and Boston Legal. I am a fan of suits. So Matt, this is from Sheila. I just had a call with her this morning. And she said, Mark, can you pose this on open forum? I said, no problem, because Matt's the man, the myth, the legend. He can do this. So now she is a landlord. Now, some of you out there are going to relate to this. She had a bad tenant, and the tenant didn't pay some rent, also damaged the property. And Sheila was so mad. She's like, I'm not going to let this guy off the hook. So she went to court and got a judgment. Now, here's her question. She says, Mark and Matt, can you please explain to me the best way to try to collect on this judgment? Because this guy's a little squirrely, he's hard to track down, and I'm nervous about spending more money too to try to track him down with this judgment. Matt, what would you say to Sheila?
All right. Well, this is, you know, I have spent some time in court, not as a defendant. You know, I want to let's just make that clear. But that's not my, you know, my normal routine right now. As Mark likes to say, we're lovers, not fighters. But I can definitely answer this because I've been down this path before. So if you have the judgment, the first thing you can do, if you can find him and find where he works, you can do a garnishment of wages or bank accounts. So if you do find his employment, you can send a garnishment notice with the judgment to the employer, and they'll start withholding funds from this person's paycheck. If you can find where they bank, you could also zap money out of their bank account with the garnishment. And if you have the judgment, you're good to go with that. Now, in terms of additional costs, the problem is going to be you're going to have to go back to the court to have them award more costs. So if you're paying money out of pocket to track the guy down, that's money you're either going to spend out of pocket and just let go, or you're going to have to file more proceedings in court called a supplemental proceeding to have the court order that those additional costs be reimbursed. Now, sometimes even collection agencies will request at the time they get a judgment some money ahead of time to go track the person down, and they'll get a small amount kind of pre-awarded sometimes even. So now the last thing I wanted to say on this, which is interesting, and I've had this before. I had a client had about $100,000 judgment against someone on a real estate transaction, and this person, we had the judgment against them, we won the case, but they weren't paying. So we pulled them into court under what's called a supplemental proceeding, and they have to show up in court. If you can get them served, they have to show up in court. If they don't, they get a bench warrant issued, and they can get, you know, they got a warrant out for their arrest if they don't show up. So if it gets to this, you can do what's called a supplemental proceeding and make them show up in court to disclose under oath where they work, where their bank accounts are, how much money they make, what assets they have. You can get into all that detail from them if you have a judgment against them and they haven't paid it. And when I did that with this client, they realized they were under oath, the person that owed the money on the judgment, and there's a judge there telling them, you've got to tell this attorney everything. And this lady was fighting it. The judge is like, no, you got to tell him all this information. And this lady had deeded property out of her name to her kids and everything. She was trying to get any assets away from her. And we knew that. So I told that to the judge, and the judge is like, yeah, you're going to have to tell them all these assets you gave to your kids. You're going to have to tell them where all of it is. And you got to give them copies of these deeds. And by the way, they're probably going to be able to go get those assets. So after that supplemental proceeding, this person who owed the money decided, oh, I better just pay this thing, which they did, and we were able to collect on it. So supplemental proceeding, that's where you may end up if you have to.
Yeah, and I just add, Sheila, that I from – just kind of a watching from the bench, if you will. That's not being a judge bench, but from watching the players on the field. What I've seen very common is that if you go back to court and tell the judge, this person's being squirrely, I'm trying to collect this judgment, and I've had to pay X number of dollars that's reasonable for a private investigator or a collection agency, they're going to award those funds. You're going to be able to really track this person down. And what's fun is what I've seen on supplemental proceedings is they'll get them in court and they'll say, okay, what's in your wallet? What's in your purse? I've got a 20. Great. Hand it over. I mean, they'll just drain their bank, and they'll drain their bank account or other things too. So it could be a very fulfilling experience as a creditor to see your debtor finally squirm and pay, because they're going to try to get out of it. So keep up the good fight, Sheila. Don't let this guy off. Drag his butt into court and start garnishing wages too.
All right. Well, I've got a question here, Mark. This was from Philip. Philip has been approached about investing into a marijuana dispensary business. And this would be in the state of California and possibly Arizona. Both of those states right now, I don't know if you know this, have initiatives on the ballot for November 8th, this upcoming election, to make marijuana legal for recreational use, not just medical. Those two states, Arizona, California, right now, you can only have marijuana legally if you have a medical like permit, or I don't know what they call it, but for medical purposes. But now they're going to try and make it legal in those states and a couple others, actually, for recreational use. So this is a client had a question about investing in this. We've had clients invest in some of these businesses. I mean, there's a lot of green in it. You can have some high profits for sure, but you want to be careful.
Yeah. So what's the question on that, Matt? Then like the tax situation or what?
The question is whether it's legal to be investing into a medical marijuana business or if it is legalized in California or Arizona, into a company that is selling marijuana for recreational use.
Yeah, I mean, totally. So kind of funny.
I thought you were going to laugh at my jokes, by the way.
Yeah, I was. They were good. They were good. You know, I apologize. I was actually thinking through some of the situations we've had with clients investing in dispensaries, and I was thinking where this question was going to go. So let me give just a couple hurdles out there. Of course, you don't want to invest in a medical marijuana dispensary in Utah or Idaho. If someone pitches you on that, you will go to jail. So you want to make sure you're in the right state with the right type of dispensary. So Matt, I like what you're saying there. But a couple other things. The federal government does not recognize these dispensaries as a legal business at this juncture. So when you go to file taxes, you're going to get cost of goods sold, and that's it. It's a very, very heavy tax situation, because you can have a difficult time really drumming up write-offs. Now, at the state level, like in Colorado, for example, they'll give you all the regular write-offs if it's like any other business, because the Colorado state legislature said, no, this is a legit business. But the feds are going to go, no. We're going to tax the crap out of you because you don't deserve to have all these write-offs, because we don't recognize this as a legal business. So be careful there. Also, banking can be a big challenge. A lot of the bigger banks, they don't want to give you a bank account if they know what type of business it is. So you're going to deal with credit unions and regional banks in that state that feel comfortable with the state law. But it's tough to get a bank account going, because the feds, they're scared to death. The feds are going to shut them down. So anyway.
Yeah. So there may be high profits there, but there may also be a buzzkill at some point from the federal government. That's pretty much what Mark's saying.
That was good. You worked in buzzkill. You're amazing. You're on your game today. I'm slacking. I got to drink another Rockstar or something. It's been a long day. All right. Well, here's another question. This is a good one. This is from Chris. Hi, Mark. Question about making money from selling your primary home. Love this question. I can already see where it's going. He said, we lived in our home for 4 years and 9 months. We sold it and made $130,000. I'm going to assume profit. I had someone say that because the profit is under $250,000, we don't need to pay taxes on it. Is that the real story? And I can see this. I'm skeptical. If we need to pay taxes, would buying a rental property before year end help? Like a $30,000 home in Danville, Illinois. Oh, Chris, see, that was a little inside joke there, because I own a rental property in Danville, Illinois, better known as my little meth lab. Love that little rental. So thanks, Chris, for the little dig. First, on the sale of your primary residence, if you're married, you can actually exempt up to $500,000 of profit. Single, up to $250,000. So Chris, you're loving this answer. You only have to live in the home and own it 2 out of 5 years. You're well over that with 4 years and 9 months. So man, maybe the best news you've received all day, no tax on the sale of your primary residence. And as an aside, if you were to rush out and buy a rental property before year end, it wouldn't help either, even if this was taxed, because you might get some deductions for buying a rental that could offset some of your income, but it's not built to be a direct write-off against the sale of your home, because you cannot do a 1031 exchange on the sale of your own home into a rental. So I would the rental is a good reason. I mean, there's lots of good reasons to buy a rental anyway, but in this situation, you don't need to worry about it, nor would it help if the home was even taxable. Matt?
Yeah, that's sweet. That's like one of the few ways you can make money and not have to pay tax in the U.S. Sell your home for a profit. That's good news. Sometimes we get a bear good news, right, Mark? I mean, it's. All right. Well, I got a question from Michael. He wrote in two questions, but let's hit this one first maybe. He said, what are the pros and cons in using an umbrella insurance policy for liability protection instead of forming an S corporation or LLC? Now, this is a good question, and one that a lot of people consider, particularly those in California where you have really high fees on LLCs. And what we recommend generally is that if you're concerned about asset protection, let's say you got a rental property or a business, you maybe should be doing both. Now, let me go over umbrella insurance, though, quickly, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. Umbrella insurance, all that is additional insurance for what you already have protection for. So a lot of people think of an umbrella like being over the top of your head and covering any raindrop from touching you. Not, don't think of it that way. Think of whatever's over your head protecting you right now, and this going on top of that and only protecting what's already protecting you more. That's what umbrella insurance is. It's not protecting anything new. And of course, if you read any insurance policy, there's one paragraph that says what's covered and then 10 pages that says what's excluded. So we've had lots of clients over the years think, oh, I'll just make an insurance claim on this. I had a client with the rental property. Someone slipped and fell on it on the steps. He went to his insurance company and said, all right, defend this. I have insurance, liability insurance on the property. Insurance company comes back and says, nope, we're not going to defend it. You should have had a handrail there based on city code. You didn't, so your insurance policy is not going to cover this. The guy's like, ah, oh, great. So now if he had an LLC, then they would be stuck at the LLC. They'd have to, they'd be forced to sue the LLC. So you can use umbrella insurance. I don't know that it's an either or. And just keep in mind what umbrella insurance really is.
Well, okay. Now, I'm going to take this to a whole new level because Matt failed to mention in Michael's email a very, very important comment. At the end of his questions, he said, go Utes. Now, right there, we want to, you know, tell Michael he's, you know, a little cut above our regular questionnaires, you know, listeners to the show. Because he, as many of you may know, the Utes are now 4-0. Loving it.
They're, yeah, baby.
Ooh, they're having a great season so far. And it's been finally. Now, here is the analogy. This is really good because if Michael is a real Ute fan, he knows what has plagued the Utes in prior years, and it's a poor offense. The Utes defense has been amazing. But Matt, finally, we've got an offense, right? I mean, this is.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't. I don't know that we've played the best of teams yet. We got the hardest games still coming up on the schedule, but. We'll see. We'll be tested soon. We had USC, who turned out to be a cupcake-type team. We'll see how they do this year. But I mean, of course, you beat BYU, and who really cares about them anymore?
Yeah. So. Now, yeah, and we could get into this football thing. Some of you are cringing going, hold it, this is not a sports show. But here's the analogy. See, when it comes to umbrella insurance and an LLC, it's a 1-2 punch. You really, Michael, you want to have both. And all of you listening out there, when you have rental properties and an LLC or a business with an S-Corp, the umbrella is just a good thing to do anyway. It can cover you from uninsured motorists, teenage drivers, all sorts of things that there might be gaps in your regular insurance. The umbrella, like Matt said, is that extra umbrella on top of your regular policies. But this is how the Utes do it now, too. They've got this 1-2 punch. They're finally bringing their offense together, we hope. We're starting to see glimmers of hope. So it's kind of like having a good offense and a good defense. You want to have both, the umbrella and the LLC. I
love it. And that's how you win the game.
Woo! There you go, Matt. Oh, man, bring it home.
Now I get it. Now I get it.
All right. Now, as Matt said, Michael had two questions. His first one was, in what situations would you want to do a personal loan instead of a capital contribution in your S-Corp or LLC? What is the correct way to make a loan to your S-Corp or LLC so it seems legitimate in the eyes of the IRS, choosing a rate of interest and blah, blah, blah? Okay, Michael, let me just make short order of this. We are not the type of accounting firm that likes to book loans from the owners or shareholders to the company. Because you're loaning yourself money, you got to pay yourself interest, you got to claim interest income. The interest is probably not tax deductible. I mean, it's just kind of weird. If you're loaning to the company and the company's paying you interest back, then the company would take a deduction. But now you've got interest income. It's just weird. The best way to go about this is a capital contribution. Now, some accountants out there have a different approach to things. We are the style that if you're going to put money in your business, let's call it capital contributed. You're going to get return of capital on a tax return. It's going to be really one of the easiest and best ways to go. Now, some accountants out there are listening that are C-Corp advocates. C-Corporations, you may use a different approach where you're loaning money to the corp and the corp's paying back the loan with interest. That might be better in a C-Corp. But again, we're not a big fan of C-Corps either. So I just want to say stick to capital contributions and talk to Sandy Beecham in our office. Sandy Beecham is our accounting services director. She's phenomenal. She can meet with you and come up with a good accounting approach to your balance sheet and how your contributions are being covered.
All right. Nicely done, Mark. I'm just leaving it at that because Because I got nothing to say. All right. Well, I got another question here. This is from Rick. Rick has a question. I have some investments in my self-directed 401k and self-directed IRAs. They're invested in private placements with a long-term duration. I've identified my beneficiaries for these accounts, but how will the transfer of these investments work upon my death? All right. Now, this is a great question from Rick. Is you may know, and this is an important point, your retirement accounts, whether it's a 401k or an IRA, they are going to be distributed based on your beneficiary designations upon your death. So now you may have a will or a trust, but what you put in that will or trust is not operative. It's what's on the beneficiary designation that's key. Now, you may put your trust on the beneficiary designation. There's some planning to that, but that could be on there. But what's on the beneficiary designation is key. So now he's identified these beneficiaries on these accounts. Now, the tricky part is, as Rick's question gets to here, is what if these investments are not liquid? So the beneficiaries inherit them. Rick passes away, and they're invested in a private placement that owns an apartment building, or it's a startup company. And it's not something they can readily sell. Now, that can be an issue. And because one of the issues is now that they may have to take required minimum distributions when they inherit the account. So there are some issues with this. What I would recommend considering in Rick's situation is an IRA trust. I've actually set up two of these in the past week alone. And they're really helpful for situations like this, where you may need special planning. Last one we did for a client said, I got a bunch of rental properties. I don't want, when I die, my kids to inherit it, and they each get a third, and they have to sell all the properties so they can get them to cash so they can fairly share a third. So he said, I'm just going to give one to one, another to another, and another to another, and try and split up the cash to make up the difference. And we did an IRA trust to break up those assets, and they'll each inherit their own IRA with their own specific rental property. You may be able to do this with the private placement in your situation, Rick. There's a lot of things to consider there, the age of your beneficiaries. But this is a really key issue to be looking at. If you have a self-directed account, you're getting older, making sure you understand the beneficiary rules, and maybe even considering a trust for the IRA or 401k.
Woo!
I tried.
Yeah. All right. Well, okay. I love it. Now, we've got another question here. We're going to switch over to healthcare for a minute. Now, this is are we not on the cusp, people, of some we're going to be doing a radio show or two dedicated to healthcare over the next couple months. Yeah, because enrollment period starts November 1st. This is a very difficult time of year because, Matt, just today, it's ironic, we've got a question on this from Tom, is that I just got my letter from the insurance company that said, here's your increase on your insurance for the premiums for next year, and buckle up. And and I'm looking at about a 10 to 20% increase in my insurance premiums for another year. So lots to talk about.
It's painful. My insurance carrier is no longer going to be providing coverage in the state of Arizona. Oh, great.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So, anyway, this is going to be a common question or topic that we're going to be covering. And we want all of you to encourage you to continue to listen to the open forum as we take healthcare questions. And we're going to have a couple shows on healthcare. Mm-hmm. So, this question from Tom says, I work for an employer who offers a flexible spending account, FSA. Now, we'll bring it around to HSAs and HRAs here in a moment. But he's got one of these flexible spending accounts. And folks, this is the use it or lose it type of plan. So he says, may I use the funds from my FSA to travel to my doctor's appointment, usually over 500 miles? Wow. That's your doctor's. I thought my doctor was far away. He says, I work on the road as a trucker, and occasionally I need to leave my truck in Texas and fly to Nevada for my medical treatment or evaluation. Can I stay for a few days of relaxation or have another doctor's appointment within a few days before I return flight? Man, I was loving all this, but I like how he's saying Nevada and your doctor's in Vegas. Tom, man, you put some loaded language in here. This is a tough one. And he's like, I need massages. I need acupuncture. I've got, you know, boy, this is tough. Let me say this in general. First of all, whether it's a flexible spending account, a health savings account, or a health reimbursement arrangement, any of these type of healthcare plans, not just use it or lose it, FSAs, but even your health savings account or HRA, can pay for legitimate medical travel. Now, typically, that's going to mean airfare and hotel and even food while you're getting treatment for your medical problem. And this the reason this was in the code is for people that may need to travel for far away for a surgery. And that those housing and food costs while you're there for that surgery or whatever should be covered, right? Or deductible in your medical situation. Now, if you're driving, it's going to be mileage. So one thing to keep in mind, Tom, is that if you're going to drive this 500 miles to get back to your doctor, you could get challenged under audit that, well, were you traveling home anyway? Why is your doctor 500 miles away? I mean, there's some unique things that I'd want to have some answers to before we throw it on your tax return. But anyway, the point is, I think for everybody listening here, is that travel, including lodging and food, is a tax-free withdrawal from a flexible spending account, HSA or HRA. And I'm going to pull up while we're here on the show the publication for medical withdrawals, and that might help some of you look this right up so that you can do it. And it's publication 502. I just want to make sure I had the right number. So go to Google and look at publication 502, and then go to medical, travel, lodging, meals, and you're going to see exactly what is deductible. So there you go.
Ooh,
Matt,
nice.
Back at you.
Yeah, man, that was an interesting one. I actually didn't know it was going to go that way. I was thinking you were going to go the other way on that. You get a write off your travel. I mean, I hope he's staying at like the Bellagio or somewhere nice, not like, you know, the Red Roof Inn or something. Make it count, Tom. and don't get like a turkey sandwich, you know, or In-N-Out. I mean, get room service. Let's do this right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, I think we got to stay on this healthcare topic. It's a big one. And, you know, open enrollment is like 32 days away. November 1st for 2017. Can you believe it? Oh my gosh. Okay. Everybody be excited. Be excited. You're going to have to. So, all right. I got another question though on HSAs that came in. This is related here. So the question was, is it a good idea or right thinking to actually send money to my HSA from my S-Corp, then pay the insurance premium from it as well, along with medical expenses? So they must have an S corporation already. And I don't know this person's name. It comes in like a company name here. We don't have your name here, but she does love Mark. She's seen him speak and travel. So, and she's loved learning about HSAs from him. So Mark, now on the HSA, I mean, you're not going to pay that from the S corp. That's going to be down at the individual level typically, from what I understand. You're going to be funding it, obviously, and contributing to it. What about this insurance premium, though? She's asking, how do I pay the insurance premium? Does it come from the HSA, from the S-Corp, personal?
Oh, this is a huge question. And folks, this is one you got to pay attention to. So if you're kind of lollygagging along to the show and not paying attention to some of these healthcare topics, this is critical. If any of you out there have an S-corporation and are paying for your own health insurance, those premiums, they must be paid by the S-Corp. This is an IRS ruling. So it's absolutely critical. Technically, you don't get the write-off unless the S-Corp pays the premium. So that's rule number one. Number two is that when you do your W-2, because if you're an S-Corp owner, you're doing your salary dividend split. Huge topic. We love that. Folks, if that sounds shocking to you, catch my book, a chapter on that, or listen to our radio show in the past on S-Corps. We dedicated a whole show to it this last year. But you've got to, on your W-2, if you're an S-Corp owner, you also have to indicate how many, the dollars, how much premiums you paid out of the S-Corp for health insurance. So that ensures the deductibility of those premiums. And frankly, it should have nothing to do with your HSA. I want you to build up your HSA for all the other things, copays, deductibles, eyes, teeth, travel, like Tom said, to Vegas for your doctor. How strategic is that to have your doctor in Vegas? But the point, you really want to make sure that you're using the S-Corp to pay the premiums and then use your HSA to pay for the extra things, because you get a write-off for both. See what I mean? Why get a write-off to put money in the HSA and then pay for it out of the HSA? You get a write-off anyway. So just pay for the premiums right out of the S-Corp, then put money into your personal account and fund your health savings account. The S-Corp can fund the health savings account, but it's going to be recorded as a draw anyway. So anyway, get a consult on this with your accountant. Make sure you're on the same page on your payroll and your premiums, and that it's being recorded in your books accurately.
All right. Nicely done. See, I mean, I'm just thinking right now, man, I'm doing my tax returns this year. Finally, because, you know, I filed an extension. I'm like, crap, I did that right. Yeah, I did that right. Whew, man. Yeah. So I love how you said tune in, because that was a little technical there, I have to say. I'm glad we have a CPA on this show. Jeez.
Well, I'm glad we have an IRA expert, because that's our next question.
This is
from Randy. He said, very recently, TIA CREF and a major university who employs my wife blocked an in-service transfer to fund our newly formed IRA LLC. Citing the reason was that it was not a transitioning event to retirement. She wasn't getting fired. She wasn't retiring. They just wanted an in-service rollover. She's 60 years of age, and she was only asking for her vested amount. She wasn't asking for any contributions or matching or growth, just the vested amount. And the question is, what is the custodian, employer, sponsor duty of disclosure here? We can't locate any restrictions of this kind on their website or documents. We don't have the original plan document she got 17 years ago. Something's weird. Why are they blocking this? Any suggestions? Matt Sorensen.
Ooh, yeah, this is an interesting one. So the general rule, and what most plans do, is once you're at retirement age under the plan, which some company plans are 55, most are 59 and a half, you're able to roll out any vested balances to an IRA. So if you wanted to self-direct, you still work there, you could roll it out. Now, in this situation, I believe she's 60, so I would think she'd be able to roll out. That's going to typically be the treatment. Now, what you'll need to look for, there's two documents where this is typically covered. The first is called the adoption agreement. So in the 401k plan, or the, you know, this retirement plan document, you can ask the administrator, I want a current copy of it. They have to provide it to you. If they don't, there's legal ramifications to them. Ask them for a copy of the adoption agreement and the plan document. One of those two documents is going to indicate rollover and in-service withdrawals and rollovers. There's going to be a section on that. And it'll say, and there's like boxes they check. You'll be able to roll out money once you're at retirement plan age, and they'll indicate that age. Like I said, it's usually 59 and a half, so I'm surprised this got blocked. But you do want to check, ask for the adoption agreement and plan document. There's going to be a section on in-service withdrawals and rollovers. The answer is going to be there.
All right, Matt, excellent. I'm so glad I have an IRA expert. I would have fumbled that question and dropped the ball, much like a BYU running back. So
we're a good team here, you know.
Yeah,
we're a good team.
All right, now this is a question from Facebook. This is Brian. He says, if a person has a small business, can they put their niece and nephews on payroll to save taxes? Oh, Brian, I love this. Matt, we're getting a good cross section of questions today.
Yeah.
So, family members on payroll. Now, for any of you new listeners, or some of you that need to brush up on this topic, again, I've got articles on this on my blog, on our law firm blog. We've got a radio show dedicated to hiring family members on the iTunes history, as well as videos on my website and the whole chapter in my book. So if this question is not sufficient for some of you listening today, please look at those resources and give us a call to have a consult on this. In a half hour, we can break down a strategy for you. Now, specifically to Brian's, he says, nieces and nephews. Now, that's a tricky one. because if you, there's certain exemptions for putting your own children on payroll. You don't have to withhold FICA and withholdings. And if they're under age 18, only in the state of Washington, you have to worry about workers' comp. I don't know why. Apparently, kids are suing their parents for injuries there. But paying your own kids, on putting your own kids on payroll is a lot easier than a niece or nephew. So here's the short answer. Nieces and nephews, they're going to get a 1099. It's just the way to do it. Now, if they're going to act and look and smell like an employee and show up and quack like a duck and talk like a duck, then obviously they're a duck. You got to do a W-2 with the rest of the employees as, that are acting like that niece or nephew. But if you got the niece or nephew helping you with social media, being a janitor, stuffing envelopes, taking care of a rental property, just give them a 1099 and you get a tax write-off. And they've just created a small business. Now they're getting write-offs. So good thing. So, Brian, great question. Get those kids on a 1099.
Yeah, and for those kids, I mean, this is good because you're getting a tax deduction on your side. You're likely in a higher tax bracket. They may be picking up income, but they're going to be in a low tax bracket likely. Yeah, I presume they're younger here. And for some of them, it might even help them get certain tax credits, you know, because there are incentives for people to be making some money. And then you pay taxes once you get over a certain amount, obviously. But yeah, this could be great. Obviously, it's awesome to have family in the business. Now, we're getting to the end of the show here, Mark. I'm just scanning back through to see what questions I may have passed on.
Yeah,
I've got any more here?
Yeah, I got a couple, and they're fast and easy. I think we can knock them out in short order. This is from Shirley out in California. She says, we will be closing our business. We have an S Corp in our businesses in California. We stopped taking on new business back in March and have collected all the outstanding receivables, paid all outstanding payables. Other than closing the business bank account and submitting our final tax return, what else do we need to do to close our business? Are there forms we need to complete? Or other entities we need to notify. Thanks so much, Mark. Love the show. Thanks, Shirley, for the question and your kind words. Now, this is really important for any of you out there, anywhere in the country, closing down an LLC or a corporation, and especially in California. There's one last thing you need to do, Shirley, and that is file articles of dissolution. Articles of dissolution will be filed with the Secretary of State. That's the same process in every state in the country right now. You file those articles of dissolution. Now, the timing is critical for you in California because you want to make sure they receive those articles of dissolution before you turn the corner on another tax year and face that $800 minimum tax, which you and I both hate. So make sure you file that articles of dissolution before the end of the year. I'd like to see you file it in November, early December at the latest, making sure that it's sealed, stamped, and delivered by the state before 12/31. So, great question.
Yeah, and usually we'll do some little minutes there, you know, documenting that and closing it down. You put it in your corporate records, and then that company is done. Keep in mind, though, this is one question we sometimes get as follow-up to that. Even if you dissolve a company, let's say there's some liability that comes about from last year, you're still going to get the benefit of the corporate veil. So it's okay if you dissolve. You're not going to have liability protection moving forward for anything if that business does something moving forward. But when it was open and active, there was a liability in the past that comes out of nowhere. You're still going to get that corporate veil protection and treatment. So don't feel like you got to leave it open to get that because, as Mark said, you're going to get dinged $800 a year for that in California.
Yeah. Hey, Matt, I got a VRBO question. Can I hit it real quick?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So this is Ron out in California, Huntington Beach. Ron, love you. Just great to see your name here and face with your little Facebook photo. Sitting on his Harley, nonetheless. Love it. Now, here's the thing. He says, VRBO, since we are following your advice in purchasing rentals, how do we best utilize VRBOs for our rentals? Now, I am setting up a property in their online system, and they have a checkbox for tax, meaning taxing our rental customer, and there is a place to add in a tax rate. What is your recommendation for adding a tax and at what rate? Also, I'm assuming that the VRBO fees are deductible. Well, the low-hanging fruit easy answer to multiple questions here is let's go in reverse. Obviously, any VRBO fees are deductible. This is a great rental property strategy. And it's a great cash flow strategy. Start renting out your basement, your upstairs, your duplex, your rental property. Just use it strictly for VRBO. Great tax strategy. Now, quickly, Matt, I'm going to just hit a couple points. First, from a federal tax standpoint, whether or not you depreciate your home, if you're renting a room in your home, a VRBO or a upstairs or a basement, it can get a little trickier when you're doing it out of your primary residence. But for any of you that have a standalone rental property, whether you're doing VRBO or long-term rentals, you're going to use the same strategy for depreciation, tracking your expenses, claiming the income. Easy schmeasy. But here's the real issue, everybody. VRBO and any of these kind of home rental websites, there is a lot of local legislation going on this right now. There's communities that hate these short-term rentals. They don't like the traffic in these neighborhoods. They don't like the type of people it's bringing. We're even locally here had a city council meeting just last week in this little town where they're fighting over what are they going to allow in which areas and does zoning allow for this or not. So for any of you that are planning on a VRBO strategy, short-term rental, daily rental scenario for any of your properties, make sure you look at the local legislation issues. Do some Google, call the city. Don't tell them your name and address, but start asking questions. But this is a big deal. So number two is the tax issue. In Hawaii, there's a 15% tax rate on vacation rentals. In Colorado, they're just passing some special legislation in certain counties and cities where there's an extra tax rate. So these cities want to cash in on it. They're saying, hey, if you're going to do a VRBO, we want to tax you for the amount of rent you're collecting. They're going to treat you like a hotel or motel, and there's going to be some sort of tourism tax rate. So again, I don't know what the rate's going to be in your local area, Ron, or what's, you know, that where the rental is, but you're going to want to do some good, solid research on what those tax rates are. And there's going to be a tax return filed locally. Matt, right there in Maricopa County, even with long-term rentals, there's a Maricopa tax on long-term rentals. So got to be aware of this, folks, and make sure you do your homework.
Yeah, and that's the option. If you're clicking there on VRBO, you can pass that tax along. It gets added on through VRBO in the transaction, and the actual tenant, you know, paying it, they're, that you're leasing to, is going to have to pay it. Just like when you get a hotel room for $299 a night and you check in and it's actually $379. That's all the taxes you had to pay, all the tourism taxes. So that's what they're asking you for there, is that data. And that's key, because here's the trick. If you're not adding that in on the front end like this on the site, guess who's going to be responsible to pay it? You are. And that's going to come out of your pocket when everyone else searching for VRBOs in your area is probably calculating this in and everyone's seeing it. So you're going to be the one holding the bag and having to pay this at the end. So really important to understand that. And you only got to know it for your area. You know, if you just got this rental in just one town, look it up, make sure you understand it for your city and state.
Yeah. Last question, and then Matt, you could take us out. This is from Three Phase Industries. Is there a certain dollar amount when you should consider having your LLC taxed as an S-Corp? Our standard rule is if you're making more than $3,000 or $4,000 a month net, you better be thinking about an S-Corp. So that's about $30,000 a year. Call your mom, then call us. Let us know. Let us help you out. So get that LLC converted to an S-Corp. You may even want to retroactively do it for the whole year. And once you're an S-Corp, you have to wait 5 years before you can go back to an LLC. That was part of their question too. Once I make my selection, can I switch back if I want to? Yeah, 5 years from now. So talk to your accountant. We can be there to help guide you through it. Give us a call. All of our contact information, of course, is in the show description. Matt.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, you know, it's like joining a gang when you make that S-Corp election. I just want to chime in on that. You know, you might, it's easy to jump in to the gang, but if you want to get out, you know, you got to pay your dues to get out. So make sure you know when before you go, like so to speak. Mark, I love doing open forum. I loved all these questions we got. We get so many broad spectrum of questions, from IRAs to taxes to liabilities to entity setups, and what's the right type of company to set up, asset protection. So thanks so much, everybody, for sending your questions and participating.
Yeah, and Matt, we got a 5-star review. I just want to quickly say that. This is from Joshua, and Joshua just earned himself a free copy of one of our books. Jake will be reaching out to you to find out which book you want, Joshua. But on Amazon, on iTunes, please forgive me, got Amazon Prime on my mind. He said, let's see, I want to get the right quote here. He says, guys, keep up the great work. Really love all the useful information that you share, and gave us a 5-star from Bronx, New York. So, Josh, thank you. We really appreciate that. And if any of you give us a 5-star review, we want to break 100 this year. we're close. So folks, go and just click on the button. It only takes a few minutes. Give us a 5-star review, copy paste it, send us an email, and you just earned yourself a free copy of a book at about a $15 to $20 value. So please do that. Okay, Matt, take us out.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Make sure you're checking out the newsletter to see our upcoming shows. We're announcing them there. Also, you can always find the shows on refreshyourwealth.com. Of course, there's the podcast on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with another amazing hour of refreshing strategies.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.